episode of Unpublished. My name is James.
And I'm Amy.
And we have one microphone today. So if you remember our car episode from a few months ago, it'll be a bit like that. We'll be having to remember to not speak until the other person hands the microphone over. We are lying on a bed at a friend's holiday house. And I don't know why I didn't bring my microphone. I'm just a silly Billy, I guess. Big silly Billy. But we are doing Q&A part two. And Amy, I know the original plan was for us to do that thing where we record it separately, but logistically, we couldn't be bothered, essentially. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. So what we're going to do today is we are still going to answer the questions individually. So I will ask the question, then James will give his answer. I'm not allowed to say anything. Then I'm going to give my answer. And then we can kind of come together and... You don't think so?
I hate the background noise.
You hate the background noise? Would you like to pause?
Yes.
Okay, background noise gone. James, happier?
Much happier.
Great. So we're going to go through these questions. There's quite a few writer-specific ones today, but there's a real great, like, variance of questions being asked. So we're going to dive into them. Let me just grab them, and you can start first, James.
That sounds good. What we got?
Do you have any suggestions on how we can find a workflow that would work for us? I've tried writing every day for at least 30 minutes and I can't seem to keep up with it.
Yeah, I think maybe we mentioned this last week that we used to be much bigger on writing or doing your art every day, but we've softened on that a lot. It works for us really well, but that doesn't mean it's going to work for you very well. And of course, finding your own rhythm is something that is hard and can take some time. And I guess what I would say would be that I think you should play around a lot more with that routine. Like, have you only tried the morning? Have you only tried the afternoon? Have you tried writing at 9 o'clock at night? Have you tried writing at 5 in the morning? You know, have you tried changing environment? Have you tried only writing on Saturdays and Sundays and writing a little bit more? Do you have something to say about this? No? You feel like you're happy with where I'm going with this?
Well, I'll do my answer.
Okay. Oh, so you're like, I'm fully doing my entire answer.
Yeah.
What if I just don't have a lot to say?
Well, that's fine.
Okay, cool. Sorry. Moving on. And then I think the thing that we've found, and I'm by no means an expert on this, but say a lot of our listeners have ADHD and they find that consistency is just not practical for them at all. And that's totally fine. And we want to do an episode on this at some point. I know we've said that a lot, but it'd be great to get an expert on. Especially, or even some people to share their lived experiences, because I know that we do have a lot of ADHD creatives who have found a way to make rhythm work for them. And it is just a different rhythm. It's just a matter of, you're going to have, once again, I don't know if you have ADHD, but even if you are neurotypical, you might also just have rhythms that are different to ours. And rhythm can be off, on, off, on, or off, 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 on, off, 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 on. That's totally fine. I think the thing is just to be... I think it's important to feel like you are making some progress over time rather than having very, very, very long periods where you do nothing. And that could mean just being really prepared for the next time you inspiration strikes you, for example. So you might already have a strategy in place, being like, when I feel inspired to write, I'm going to do this, this, and this. I guess that's my answer.
Beautiful. Okay. It's time for my answer. I mean, I actually really do agree, obviously, with everything James says. We don't differ on opinions in this. I think the idea of play is really important. So get, like, geeky about it. Get really curious. Write down, like, 10 different ways that you could, like, think you might enjoy creating and test them out a week at a time. And write down feedback and, you know, have, like, a log and figure out what works for you. As James said, there are so many different ways that you can approach this. Time of day, length of time, frequency. It is so important that we find our own rhythm. And I think we live in a society that is told that specific rhythms are best, but there is no pace like your pace. There is no pace like your pace. There is no pace like your pace. Like, literally, you have to honor that. I think that can almost harder than finding your own rhythm is honoring your own rhythm, and understanding, like, when you found something that works, or it's not enough, or it doesn't look enough, etc., etc. Really making sure that those voices don't overtake you and make you lose reverence and lose respect for your own rhythm. Like, once you've found it, treasure it. And also, you've got to understand that it will change over time. Okay?
That's great.
Anything you want to say about that?
No, that was great.
Great. Okay. This question I always find really hard, but I'm going to ask it. How do we get self-published? Okay, actually, there's a lot of questions here. This is from one person, but it says, how do we get self-published? How do I create a following on my page? How do we get people to want to buy our books? So that's a really, really big question from Michelle there. Do you want to start off?
So obviously, you know, how can we get self-published is you have to pick yourself, right? And you have to just be willing to... The advantage of having a publisher, right, and finding a publisher is that they're going to deal with a lot of the logistics for you. That's one of the main advantages of finding a publisher. Are you picking something on your foot right now?
Why are you dubbing me in?
Because it's just, it's distracting me. It's like my head is at... I'm lying on the bed and Amy's sitting on the bed and my head is at her foot level, basically.
Sorry, I got bit by an ant.
I know you got bit by an ant. I'm sorry, Michelle. I'm very sorry, but the foot thing was important to deal with.
I'll stop.
You can do it. It's okay. It's okay. Okay, so obviously the advantage of getting a publisher is they're going to do a lot of logistical things for you. If you are going to self-publish, one of the great advantages of it is that you have a lot of control. You have complete control, but that also means you also have a lot more responsibility. Now, Amy and I obviously, I don't know if you know this, but Amy and I pay a lovely lady called Linda, and Linda does all of the logistics for our self-published books. So that might not be an option for you, obviously, which means you're going to have to put in a little bit more time. So we are not the greatest help on the practicalities of getting self-published because we pay Linda to do it. Which, would you agree with that, Amy? So I might... What was the second part of the question?
How do I create a following on my page?
Yeah, I mean...
You go. You answer it, then I'll answer it.
Okay, because my ideas might be different to Amy, and just take mine with a grain of salt because my just come from observing Amy, basically. And when I look at Amy and how Amy grew her following... It once again came down to just making... It came down to two things. It came down to consistency and posture. So consistency, just getting people to trust that you're going to show up for them. It doesn't have to be every day. Getting people to trust that you are a presence that's going to give them interesting free content regularly. The second thing is posture. So when we talk about posture, what we're really talking about is showing up as someone who you would want to follow. Showing up and presenting yourself as someone who is worth being is worth following, and has something interesting to say. So this often, and your posture is going to be different. Everyone's posture is going to be different. So for example, you might not want to be very didactic. You might not want to be telling people what to do, but you might want to be suggesting how people might do stuff. But you want to be doing it in a way that is confident and that is people are going to find. That they are sort of drawn to, and I don't know, I'm not describing this well. Can you take over for a second?
Yeah, of course. I know where you're coming from. The posturing conversation is such a big conversation that we have regularly. And like when I changed my posture to, it was really, I just backed myself. Like I was apologetic about showing up on social media. I felt cringe and I was like, you know, who am I to take up space in this way? But when I was like, well, you know what? I want to write books. I want to sell books. I want to talk about creativity. And when I really took up space in that way and backed myself, my growth was bananas. There's something very magnetic about knowing your own worth and knowing that you deserve to take up space. And when we take up space apologetically online, and I think a lot of us unknowingly do it, it just doesn't have that pizzazz. It doesn't have that attraction. And that's not to say you don't get to be authentic. I'm not saying fake it till you make it. I'm not saying, you know, be extroverted and loud. I'm just saying take up space in the way that you want to, and don't apologize for it. Yeah. Okay, so my answer to how do I create a following on my page. Like I could, this is a whole podcast, honestly, and we could get into the fucking nitty gritty bits of it. But I just want to remind everyone that my following on Instagram has been built since 2014. So that's nearly 10 years ago. It's been a very slow progress build, and it's taken a lot of time and consistency. What James said about consistency is huge. I have constantly shown up and people can trust that I will show up. And that doesn't mean, don't anyone even think of taking it. That means that I don't have breaks. Of course I have breaks, but like, and over the last 9 years, I've been on there and I've been showing up vulnerably as a creative. And I know that that's going to be disheartening to some of you, like, oh my God, 10 years, that's such a long time. It doesn't have to take 10 years. Obviously some people create, you know, very large followings very quickly. But I think consistency is a part of it, no matter if you grow it fast or if you grow it slow. If we want to look at like just practicalities, I think the reason why I have been able to grow quickly is I have very, very shareable content. People want to repost. People want to share my words. People want to comment on my words. And I think having an angle that makes it shareable is a really just very strategic way to approach socials. And then the question, like, okay, well, how does writing fiction novels, how can that be shareable? And that's a great marketing question for you to get weird about and creative about. Like, how can you make a book really shareable? But these are the questions I think we have to ask ourselves as creatives. And I think, you know, you've got to make it so that people want to spread your work around. And I think it's often why, like, influencers can get quite people who do fashion and people who do, like, kind of what's the word, like, do you know, lifestyle? Like, lifestyle, and they often have very low engagement, and it can be quite hard to grow a lifestyle brand because no one really wants to share their content. It's a harder approach, it's a different approach when you're more of a lifestyle content creator, because it's less shareable, which is something I've noticed. They have less comments, less interaction. That's not to say you can't grow an incredible brand. Obviously, lots of people have, but it is interesting because I think it's a lot less shareable. The last question on this part.
It's actually such a hard format because I keep wanting to say something, but I have to wait so long and I keep forgetting what I want to say, which is obviously a normal thing. I often forget what I want to say. But I was going to say, it's also important, I think, not to get obsessed with the number on your social media following. And I think trying to cultivate quality fans and quality followers is much, much, much more important than trying to cultivate numbers alone. So there's that really famous article, 1000 True Fans by, I forget who it's by.
It's by Seth Godin.
No, Seth Godin always, I think Seth Godin quotes it, doesn't he? He talks about it. Oh. I don't think it's his idea. Oh. And it's like, you're much better off having 1000 people who really, truly believe in you and who are like raving fans than 100,000 people who are like, meh. It's fine. It's much more valuable to have the 1,000, which is...
Can you tell them about that influencer who, like, had a million followers but didn't...
Oh, yeah. Do you know the story?
I don't know who it was, but it was this story about an influencer who had, like, millions of followers, and they started a brand, like, a line, and they could not sell, like, anything. It was run at a significant loss, and I think that's just a perfect example of that, right? Like, we need relationships with these people, especially as artists. We need relationships with the people who are following us. The number, of course, is important in some ways, but if the number isn't important if you don't have relationships with them. And so developing relationship and developing trust and communicating with the people that, you know, witness your art and letting them see you, letting them feel like they know you in some way. It's a bizarre relationship that you make online, but it is a holy one and a true one and something that I really treasure. Like, I have incredible, incredible relationships with people from my Instagram, and it's nothing to be sniffed at all. Okay, so the last question in this little box of amazing questions from Michelle is, how can we get people to want to buy our books?
I mean, books specifically is an interesting one for us because this is something that Amy and I have had a lot of long conversations with about lately, is trying to think of interesting ways to market Amy's fiction books. We found it a lot easier to market the nonfiction books, I think. It was much more on message for Amy and Amy's page, and trying to convert to fiction has been harder to nonfiction. No, to fiction has been harder than converting to nonfiction because we haven't, I think we were quite nailed our message on how to convert to fiction yet. Amy's fiction sales are good, but I think that we, for the audience sides we could have put in a lot more time and effort and made a much more interesting marketing around it. Yeah. Do you have anything you really want to say about this?
I think it's one of my most, like, I'm really interested in it at the moment. And as James said, like, both of us are, like, fascinated by this because I think we really want a renaissance of my fiction, of our fiction. Like, at the end of the day, that's what we are. We're fiction authors. And as we began this business, you know, we put a lot of effort onto the nonfiction side of things, and it's my heart definitely belongs there. But I think we're having much more of a focus towards how can we get people to buy our stories. And so it's going to be a big journey for us, and I'm excited to take you all with us. But a few thoughts that I've had immediately are just like asking good questions. They're classic marketing questions, but this is what we're doing. We're marketing our novels. It's like, where would you find your readers? Like, where will you find your readers? So, for example, for me, historical fiction, like, where do historical fiction readers, like, where can I find them? Where can I access them? What do they love? And where do they go? And just like asking those kind of questions, like how can I infiltrate those spaces? What content do they like to consume? You know, I know historical fiction, like this is literally off the top of my head right now. I'm going historical fiction. I'm going towards like the Bridgerton fanatics. They love dresses. They love fashion. They love the aura and the ambiance of the season. How could I create content that looks like that? You know, how could I create something that looks, you know, different to what everyone else is doing? Like, these are the questions that I would ask myself, and I need to ask myself as we keep going.
There's a really good YouTuber called Daniel Green who has been really successful converting his YouTubing audience, which is not actually about his own books or self-publishing. It's about fantasy and science fiction in general. And then he does publish fantasy and science fiction, but he's mostly publishing other people's content on news up until the point he self-published his own book. He has two really good videos on it, which I'm going to try and put in the captions. One is literally he released last week or so, and it was, I think, something about, basically it was 30 minutes of him saying how if he was publishing his book for the first time now, what he would do. And then he's got another one, a really good interview. He might have multiple interviews with self-published authors, but there's a fantasy author who writes a book called The Rage of Dragons, and his name is Evan Winters, I believe. I might be getting that wrong. And he did a really, really successful self-pub of his fantasy novel. And he's got a great interview with Daniel Green as well. And I'll try and put both of those into the show notes.
Amazing. And I really hope that as we take this a little bit more seriously, we get to bring you along with it and bring along strategies and stuff for all the writers and authors that are following us. Okay. And so I've just realized I've fucked it. And so those questions were from Nicole. Thank you, Nicole.
I thought they were from Nicole.
I'm sorry. Don't be sassy with me.
I wasn't trying to sass you.
Oh, sorry. I'm defensive. I'm tired. Okay. This question is from Michelle. What are the ways you battle insecurity? How can I push back against the voice that tells me I'm not good enough, talented enough, capable enough? What helps you expand and play less small? Concrete tips to build confidence as an artist creator. I like this framework of concrete tips. Would you like to go first?
No.
No? Okay. Right. Thank you. This is a really great question. And obviously it's a lifetime of work, and it is why so many choose not to create, because the insecurity is so obvious when you do something as vulnerable as make art. For me, the concrete tips kind of lens is harder, because for me, journaling is a concrete tip. Like, I rewrote my insecure narratives on the pages of my journal. So I would always acknowledge them, write them down. I'm not good enough. They think I'm an embarrassment. I am so childish to want this. And I would literally rewrite them. And I would take care of myself and mother myself on the pages of my journal. And that is how I've rewritten a huge amount of my insecurity. And I will say, like, I am a very secure person now. I'm very secure in what I do. I'm secure in who I am. And it has been such a blessing. And so much of that has been done on the pages of my journal. Something that I am noticing more recently is that I have to have a sense of safety, and I have to have safety practices around me as I do vulnerable things. Otherwise, I will inadvertently start playing small. So this part of the question that Michelle has asked, how do you expand and play less small? I have to feel safe in many ways in order to do risky things. That's literal, like, concrete things. I have to know that I'm going to be in bed at a certain time. I have to know that I'm going to be able to eat the food that I want to eat. I have to know that I've got a book that I want to read. I've got a podcast that I want to read, like, listen to. Like, I need to have, like, safety latches all throughout my days. If I'm going to do something hard, I need support. I need to know that I can get home. James is going to be there. He's going to take care of me. Like, it's really simple, practical things that I need to integrate and I need to cling to. In order for me to play big. Have you thought of anything to say yet?
This is a hard one for me. Amy's further along than me in this journey, and I feel like I'm still working a lot of this out. Writing off the back of what Amy was saying, I do find that it's easy for me to, and writing off the back of our conversation we had a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, it's so easy for me to play small and just not do something, like be lazy essentially, or just do less because I'm afraid of the work, or afraid of the reaction I'm going to get. For me, just managing my energy levels is really important, and making sure I have the energy to do something, because it's going to take a lot of energy to try and play big. I mean, of course, we're often not very much concrete tips sort of people. We're kind of loath to give you something and say, this is the thing that will do this. Do you want to say something, Amy?
When you're ready.
And I just feel like if you're looking for concrete tips, I would almost turn the question back on itself and say, there's no concrete tip that's going to work for you in particular. Like you have your, you, again, this is, and this is why journaling is so good, because journaling is going to be the thing that, something that can help you unlock the deeper things and the things that are really holding you back and the things that are beneath the surface that are stopping you from playing big.
I've got, I mean, this again could be a whole podcast, really, really big topic. I think understanding where your insecurity comes from is really important. So that's a concrete fucking tip. Like, go start figuring it out. Like, what has led you to have the narratives that you have right now? Because it is not inherent and it is not deserved. So go start looking at your educational system, your parental systems. Like, why do you have an inherent belief that you're not enough? Because again, like, it is not inherent, it is not true. You have picked it up from somewhere, and understanding where it comes from often releases a lot of its power. One more thing I was going to say, which is just something that I listened to the other day and really resonated with me. Again, it's in reference to that playing big rather than playing small. I have an anxiety disorder and I often feel very like physically afraid. Like my body goes into a big fight or flight response, often over nothing. And I was listening to a podcast with Dr. Andrew Huberman and an expert on stress. I can't remember her name. It's a really good podcast by Huberman, but, and I think it's one of the more recent episodes. And she says the lion who is hunting the gazelle, both the lion and the gazelle have a really similar physiological response. So the lion who's hunting the gazelle is having a very similar response to the gazelle. The hunted and the huntee have similar physiological responses. And she's like, just talking about switching that lens, you know, when we get that big frightened response or that insecure response of like, fuck, this is too hard, I'm not enough, we get that panicked response, I feel like we can look at it from a lens of I'm the hunted or I'm like the predator, like I'm taking up space, like there's something exciting for me to go grab. And I don't know, like when they said that, like I was like, oh my god, like what if every time I experience this crippling anxiety it's because like I've got like something to go after rather than I'm being fucking attacked. I love it too. Okay, thank you so much for those questions, Michelle. So good. Tyler asks, have you guys thought about a podcast or masterclass on how to self-publish? So similar to what we spoke about before. I'd love to get a better understanding of what exactly needs to be done and where to start. I really wish that we could be better at this and we need to get Linda on the podcast. The problem is, I think it's so fucking boring because it's logistical, right? It's like, okay, how do we work with Amazon? How do we work with KDP? How do we get our fucking IBSN numbers? Like, I don't think you actually want to hear this. It's so dull. But I guess we sometimes art can be dull. Do you have anything else to add?
Not really, no. I think you're right. I think we could get Linda on.
We need to get Linda on, yeah. I'm really sorry, guys. Like, we so intentionally have taken ourselves out of that space because I knew that it would stop me from taking up space. I knew it would stop me from publishing my book. Okay. Abby says, writing nonfiction, blog posts, poetry, and memoir that holds stories of deep trauma and difficult subjects. How do you do this without triggering others, but also finding the ones who need your words to help them express and process their experience in the same situation? Do you put trigger warnings on your books or in the description of the sales pages? I've been triggered by many TV shows and books, so I don't want to do this to anyone else. I'm gonna go for this one. I have trigger warnings in Elizabeth in the front page. I think I had it in a sales page. Did I have it in the sales page? I've spoken to people. People have often come to me and asked me about the nature of the book. There's like a sexual assault scene in The Rules Upheld by No One. And I've had people message me and ask me if it's appropriate, or, you know, they understand the baggage that they have bringing or the trauma they have bringing. Sorry, baggage is not the right word. And so they have looked after themselves by approaching and asking, which I thought was really interesting. But yeah, I have trigger warnings. There's definitely ways to make sure that you do your most to make sure that people feel safe. Do you have anything else to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, put trigger warnings in. I don't think it costs you anything to put a trigger warning in. And it's always better to be respectful. And if you can, and if you can be thoughtful of other people's feelings, I think that's great. The only thing I was going to say was that if what's stopping you from saying something that you need to say is that you're worried you might trigger someone else who has had a similar experience, I mean, I just wonder if that's a little bit of you playing small,
yeah.
And a little bit of you, I don't want to say making an excuse, because obviously it would be an incredibly difficult thing to share, and it would be incredibly stressful and you need to take such good care of yourself. But I wonder if this narrative of I don't want to upset other people, when they're actually just your people, they are people who need to hear from you, the people who will appreciate your perspective and your voice, because they've gone through something very similar to you. And as long as you're respectful for them, then I understand that you've been triggered by things before, but there were probably things made by people who hadn't had your lived experience and didn't have the empathy and didn't have the experience to write about it in a way that was going to be respectful to someone like you. So you were the last person who's going to trigger someone, because you were going to know how to write respectfully to them. Like, you were the perfect person.
Yeah.
The fact that you were thinking about this makes you the perfect person to write about what you have to write, because you were going to be so respectful. And you were going to put those trigger warnings in, and you were going to treat these issues with the respect that they deserve.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be frivolous with them, and you're going to be, anyway, that's what I think.
Yeah.
No, I love that. But yeah, there's definitely put trigger warnings in. I don't think it's not your responsibility, like, entirely to make sure that everyone's perfectly okay. And, you know, sometimes when we're triggered, beautiful stuff happens and healing happens as well. So again, it's not all on you. We do what we can, and then the consumer of the art has to navigate the rest. John asks, and it's very similar to before, and I probably should have grouped these questions together, how to market books effectively to reach people who could genuinely connect with your work. Have we kind of answered that? Okay, great. Thanks, John. Abby says, do vision boards ever fit into your creative process, either in life or on a project? So as you just know, we have just, or you might not know, we've just moved out of our apartment in like a transitionary state between Australia and England. And I went through a load of crap. There was so much fucking crap in those two rooms, even though I didn't realize there was so much crap. But behind my couch, there was an old vision board from like 2017. And it was so beautiful. And it was just like, dun, 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 dun. And some things looked really different. Like, it was like, I haven't really spoken to James about this, so excuse me while I inform him. It was like, had the thinkery on it. Remember when I was like, before I started this business, I was like, maybe I want to create a like an actual physical space for creatives to be in, and I wanted to call it the thinkery. And so, you know, it was like, I have a business that's like this, and it, you know, obviously that's not how it turned out, but like, turned out like way fucking better, like way fucking better. And it was just beautiful. It's like, you know, I've married James. We've gone on a great honeymoon. I have a space that holds me, that makes me feel happy. I've published my books. I'm like, yes, all this stuff has happened. So yeah, I mean, I've literally done one vision board. That was it. And respectfully, everything came true.
That's not true. You did another vision board at the beginning of this year, didn't you?
Oh, on my journal.
Yeah, on your journal.
My journal is a vision
Do you have
board.
It? Yeah.
That's so true. So on the front of my last two journals, I've just like, printed off pictures and drawn stuff and like kind of just like envisioned my year. So it is, it's a form of vision board. I really like it because my journal is every day.
I mean, I'm a big fan of the of not goal setting, but it's almost like, I don't want to say manifestation. Amy gets annoyed at me about this, but I can't say manifestation. But basically it's manifestation, but in the science sense of like, you're priming your nervous system, and you're priming your RES, which one's the one?
A.
RAS.
Reticular activating system.
There you go, RAS feed, so that you are looking for opportunities, and you are basically telling a story about yourself to yourself so that you will follow through on that story. I'm a big fan of that. I think it's really cool. I think vision boards are a great tool for that. Do you agree?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, for me, they've been a great like kind of ancillary tool.
Yeah, you've done a lot of that sort of manifesting stuff, but in that sense, it's just preparing your mind.
Yeah, preparing my mind for the magic that is to come. Because I'm a very different, again, like I'm an anxious person, so like I often prepare for the worst. So rewiring my brain to prepare for the best has come with a lot of like resistance, and vision boards have helped that. Okay, thank you so much for that question, Abby. Lucy says, a few of us in the last create session in the Inspire Collective are on the second draft of our novels. How do you tackle the second draft? What do you focus on in this rewrite? Anything to think about before diving in? I've never really liked second drafts, but I'm quite excited to dive back in this time around. Jamie?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, because I think we're going to be different.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I don't understand how we're going to be different.
I don't know. I feel like we write
different. None of us particularly have enjoyed our second drafts in the past. I often feel like the second draft's the one I really have to get through. So I don't want to freak you out too much, because it can be really great, because in the second draft, you often discover all the great parts about your book that you really love, but you also discover the huge pile of stuff that you have to fix. And for me, I think it's not putting too much pressure on a second draft to be perfect, and almost trying to, I think that we have this thing of like, well, I'm going to almost fix it all in the second draft, but that's not true at all. I feel like for me, the magic usually happens later, more in the third and fourth draft, because you almost just have to get through the second draft just to even know what you have to fix. And it's almost just a read through sometimes to me. It's a read through where I almost make fewer changes in the second draft than I do in the third draft, I think. The second draft's more about making notes about what might need to change. It's about maybe like improving a few macro things here and there, but really it's about laying the groundwork for the third draft for me, I would say.
Okay, lol, yeah, we're exactly the same. So second draft is a read through for me. I'll make a lot of notes and I'll go like, oh my God, what the fuck? And occasionally I might play around, might add a bit sometimes, but it is a shit show. Your draft two should still be shit. It should even be shitter than your first draft, honestly. Wow. I think it could be true.
Because you change things and you always...
You change things, you fuck around in it. Like, there should be no pressure on your second draft at all. I mean, there should be no pressure on your third, fourth, really. But you really shouldn't be looking good by the end of draft two. And that's my biggest thing. Like, people are like, okay, I had a shitty first draft. Now time to fix everything. Don't you fucking even think about it. Don't you think about it. Don't let... You've, like, held the perfectionist at bay for draft one and then you're going to let them fucking loose on draft two. Don't do it. Should be a shit show. I think for a lot of people, draft two can be different if you've really meticulously done a draft one. But I think you fucked up if you've done that, respectfully.
I do think there's a big difference between how much you've planned draft one. Like, I think if you really planned draft one, like, to the scene, then draft two might be neater. But if you've pantsed it or improvised it, then draft two is going to be a shit show.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's just different. Draft two is almost when you do the organizational work that someone else might have done in their planning phase.
Yeah, I think draft two can be extremely, extremely creative, and you can really like kind of bounce off your own ideas and kind of work. It's like you're in collaboration with yourself. I almost see it like being in collaboration with like your inner child, inner artist, because you've really let them loose in that first draft, and now you're sitting them down. You're going to be like, okay, you've got some great ideas. How can we structure them together now? So kind of, I think it's playful and fun, and you don't need to get too serious too soon.
But also don't be afraid to cut mercilessly.
In draft two?
Yeah, if something's just like, even a paragraph, you just go to a paragraph and you go, nah, like, what am I trying to do there? It's messy. It's like so messy. It's creating more problems than it solves.
Yeah,
just get rid of it. Yeah. And especially in draft three and four, I would say don't be afraid. Yeah. I think get to the point, if you can, of loving to cut. That's what once I'm enjoying cutting, I know that I'm doing really good things for my novel.
It is so satisfying. Like, I think a lot of writers are like, oh, I don't want to cut. Like, learn to love it, because it is like, it can be so satisfying. Like, you're trimming the fat, you're making this the sleekest, like, just like fucking tightest book ever. Cutting is just like, I really learned to love it. Okay, cool. All right. Lucy has also asked, I'm returning to creative work after a long break and dealing. How do we deal with the expectations of previous clients, collectors, fans, and where you are with your work? Ways to figure out what you want to make again, leave the past behind as my style grows, and find inspiration again without being held back by what an existing fan base wants from you. Like, so how do you start kind of over almost? That's a big part of your journey. That's a big journey. It's exciting. Jamie, got thoughts?
My initial thought is that you don't owe them anything, and that, you know, I think also, one, you don't owe them anything, and two, if you have an existing fan base, they're going to be more interested in who you are than in, and they're going to be more interested by this stage in you as an artist almost than in necessarily like a certain style that you think that's the only reason that they followed you for. Like, they're going to want you and your art, not just some random piece that you did 5 years ago or something. I think it's much more about you.
Yeah, and that's really hard to settle into. And I think acknowledging also that some people won't come with you and you will lose people is a really big part of it. And just learning to be okay with that. Because if you can learn to be okay with that, then you've got the power, right? I mean, like, it's time to do something different. Like, we cannot stay in the same lane our whole lives, even as creatives. So, like, yeah, you'll lose people, but you'll find new people too.
something I was going to say was that when Amy did this, we talked about posture earlier, when Amy did her posture pivot from, like, I guess it was more from a down on her luck artist who didn't really believe in herself to someone who believed in themselves and who was trying to make a go of things and posturing herself a little bit more as a leader, you lost a lot of followers.
Yeah, I did. Initially.
And it was a real, like, I don't know if, how many people are still following us from those early days. Like, I don't think it would be, I mean, I think we would have lost a lot of them on the way, but we got, we gained people who were better for us. And you don't want, I mean, it's not like fuck the haters. It's like, you just genuinely don't need their business.
Yeah.
It's, you don't need their business. Like, you need the business of the people who want to, who are interested in the art you're doing now.
Yeah.
And that can seem scary because you're like, well, I had clients and I had people willing to pay. It's like, there will be, if you once had people willing to pay before, you're going to be able to find more people who are willing to pay now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think teaching your audience as well, you've got to give them a bit of space, and it's so ridiculous, I know, but like, you have to, like, you have to teach your audience that you're doing something new, and it takes time to, like, especially on the internet, like, you know, not everyone's going to see each post. Like, just continue to remind them, continue to unapologetically turn up as the way that you are wanting to turn up, and just keep telling them, this is what I do now, this is how you're going to interact with me now, this is what, if you don't like it, that's fine, go, this is who I am right now. I think the word unapologetic has to be at the center of a rebrand like this, of a rebirth like this. Like, you cannot apologize. Don't apologize for having a break. Don't apologize for doing something new. Don't apologize to those who want you to stay the same. Fuck them. Take up space. This is an extremely exciting renaissance of you and your art, and like, this is cool. Love. Okay. Changing creative disciplines, jumping from, say, painting to writing, something completely alien but new but still creative. What can we expect? What can we take with us from our previous experience, and how do we approach the new learning curve?
I think, like, you're never starting from scratch.
Yeah.
You're never starting from scratch. You know, there are skills that you have learned in whatever you were doing before that are absolutely going to make you a better whatever it is that you're moving into now. Mm-hmm. So people go, oh, I'm not a painter, I'm a writer. It's like, all of the storytelling skills that you learn from writing, all of the cultivation of audience skills you learn as a writer, all of the big ideas you had as writers, they're all things that are going to carry over perfectly into painting.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a technical skill that you don't have there, but art is so much more than just technical skills.
That's something I think I've been wanting to articulate so much recently, and you've just said it. Like, art is so much more than technical skills, and I'm so tired of this very narrow conversation around, like, technicalities. And it's why I have no interest in talking craft a lot of the time, although I do enjoy talking craft every now and again, like as we have today a little bit. But yeah, art is so much more than technical skills. You are bringing over such a huge wealth of knowledge, and this crossover, this collaboration of your writing and your painting or whatever it is, only makes this more full, more incredible, more whole, more, like, I'm so excited. Like, and you should be so excited, and you should understand that you are bringing over a wealth of gifts and of, like, stuff that you're going to give the world. Like, trust it and understand that you're very qualified, despite perhaps being technically unqualified right now. Sick. All right, this is our last question. Okay, the suffering artist victim mentality is still really fashionable and almost expected. I've actually been encouraged to exaggerate my health problems, trauma, struggle, etc., as it's considered relatable, when actually I don't want to. It makes me feel like a victim, and I don't want my art to be pity porn. If anything, I want to be the opposite. I want people to feel relieved and hopeful, and yet gatekeepers love that stuff. My work is looked down upon because it's not miserable, serious, moody, or political. Why must we always be suffering for our art to be commercial? Why can't we have fun and make lovely things? Why aren't those things respected and taken seriously too? It's a really beautiful question, actually.
I have a few things to say here. One is that I am just, I'm an anti-dystopian in many ways.
Yes.
The book we're writing at the moment, the sci-fi book we're writing at the moment, trying to lean so hard into utopia or even protopia, which is sort of like, utopia implies finishedness, and protopia implies always evolving stuff. And I think it is vastly exaggerated by gatekeepers how important dystopia and misery is. And I think that the majority of people who want to consume art actually want to consume something that's vibrant, fun, full of life. That doesn't mean there's not a place for you if you want to share trauma, or if you want to share something that's a bit darker. Of course, that is a place for that 100%. But it is a complete lie that only trauma and only darkness is serious art. It's just arbitrary. It's of course false. I mean, look at the joy so many people got from Ted Lasso, which was just a fully optimistic show basically, and it had all the same emotional resonance as a well, I mean, it had more emotional resonance in so many ways than just a depressing show and a dark show that was dark for the sake of darkness. Or even, like, look at The Last of Us versus, I don't know, maybe you haven't seen all these things, but if you look at The Last of Us versus Ted Lasso, they both achieved very similar emotional resonances coming from completely different angles.
Yeah.
And both of them deserve to be taken completely serious as art.
Yeah. Just
as, like, one of our favorite shows of all time is Adventure Time. That's a fucking stupid show. That show is just frivolity, but it is so poignant, and it is so beautiful, and it is so gorgeous, and it has important, and it's silly. It's just a silly kids show. It's one of the best shows I've ever watched, and we watch literally maybe 5 or 6 episodes of Adventure Time every night when we go to bed, and we still learn from it every time. I think you don't have to be, as you said, you don't have to be trauma porn for these people. And these gatekeepers, or these people, claim that's what they want, but it's actually not. Like, they just feel like they have to say it. People feel like they have to say that shit to seem like they're serious, but no one really believes it. It's like the Emperor Has No Clothes, you know? It's just everyone pretend they're really dark, serious artists, but actually all anyone really wants is to watch Adventure Time.
Oh my God. This is a big topic for both of us, because we really seriously, but I think this is something, it's a big pain point for us. Like, I'm so glad we got this question. From you, is it Lucy's question? I think it is. Like, what an incredible question. It's super important we talk about this, because you're right, there is a real prevailing narrative of we need to have depressing art in order to be important. Fuck it, literally fuck it. I completely agree with James. Like, it is not true. We do not want that necessarily. And if someone comes to me and tells me that all their favorite art is like all this serious, highfalutin, boring trauma art, it's an immediate red flag, and I'll be very judgy. Is that all I have to say about that? I think maybe you're right. I think maybe we dive back into this question, because I think it's really important that we talk about it. I also think there's a lot of political stuff behind this as well. You know, like a victim mentality, and like, it's interesting.
We all like to feel like we're living in the worst, darkest times. And I think we like our art. We like to pretend that we're making art that reflects like the real true nature of the world. And of course, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of fucking terrible shit that happens in this world, but that doesn't mean, like, we all know that. You just watch the news if you want to know all the bad stuff happening in the world. You don't have to have it reflected in your art.
Yeah,
you don't have to. Yeah,
I love it. I love it. What a beautiful question to finish on. And I think we will, maybe next week's podcast will be an expansion of this. We're so grateful for the Inspire Collective. We're so grateful for your questions. Thanks for just hanging with us on our bed today. It was really enjoyable. We ready to close this off?
I think so.
Okay, cool. We love you.
We love you.
Bye.
Bye.